and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse, and I'm asking myself probably the same question you might be asking today. Are there such things as secret maps of the ancient world? Well, Charlotte Harris Rees thinks so. Charlotte Harris Rees is the author of Secret Maps of the Ancient World, and also an abridged and edited version of her father's text, The Asiatic Fathers of America, Chinese Discovery and Colonization of Ancient America. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're looking for a modern-day Columbo with great eloquence, style, and grace, with a ton of humility, welcome Charlotte Harris Rees to It's Rainmaking Time. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't know what to say after that introduction.
Well, hopefully you won't do what I did when I was introduced at a tournament for tennis many, many years ago at a young age, which is I opened the match and I served the ball and hit the side of the racket with the ball and it went 500 feet across the tennis court. I was so embarrassed. Anyway, you won't do that, I'm sure.
I hope not.
One of the things that led me to reading your book and talking to you is that you were inspired by Gavin Menzies. And on Gavin's site, the author of 1421 and 1434, I had seen your book, and I've always been fascinated with maps. And I have maps all over my home and globes. I have an absolute fascination with them. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't.
And so anything having to do with discovery and exploration, I thought I was stunned when I had read Gavin's book, 1421, about the fact that the Chinese were here before Columbus. But then when I realized that you actually had access to maps from your father, who had realized that the Chinese were in America, what we call America, I guess there's another name for it, Fuxang?
Fuxang.
Obviously, I need Chinese lessons. They were here thousands of years before Columbus. That is a whole different context of discovery and revelation. Talk to us a little bit about your father.
Well, my father was born in Kaifeng, China, and his parents were missionaries there. But as early as he learned Chinese, he learned English, and so he was well-versed in the Chinese classics, including the Shanhaijing, which talked about their explorations to this beautiful land to the east of them.
In 1972, your father was in Korea in an old, what was it, a shop?
It was an antique shop. At that point in his life, my father was a missionary himself, and when he would come back to the United States, he would buy old paintings and sell them in the United States to supplement his income. So he was not looking for maps. He was looking for antique paintings. But the proprietor of the store said, well, would you look at an old map? And he said, well, sure, I'll look at it. But when he saw the map and saw that it showed Fuxang, which is where the Chinese said they had been coming, and father recognized that this was the American coastline, he said he became so weak he had to sit down. He was just flabbergasted. He said, now we know for sure where Fuxang was.
There was another person who had studied Shanhaijing.
Yes.
Is it Dr. Covey?
Yes.
Talk about his findings and his 50 years of work in understanding China's association with America.
Right. Dr. Covey, who is a professor of emeritus history at Wake Forest University in North Carolina, he had run across a book that was written by a Chicago attorney, Henrietta Mertz, in 1953, which compared the Shanhaijing, and the Shanhaijing actually gives specific directions. Now, when it was written, it said that they went to the ends of the world. And so she took particularly the eastern journeys, which would have been east of China. And she took a topographical map of the world, and she said this fits no place else but America. And so she charted some of these journeys where it said go so far and you'll see this, go so far and you'll see this. So she charted some of these journeys. Well, Dr. Covey had run across this, and then he had also studied it more. So for about 55 years now, he has been studying the Chinese journeys to America and has lectured he no longer lectures, but he was lecturing for many years on this topic.
What is the resistance to discovery in your experience? You've spent 5 years on this book. You've been to the Library of Congress, these maps that were your father's maps. What other maps did you find?
Well, at this point, it's been 7 years I've been on this journey. But I did hear about a map that's in the vault at the Library of Congress. When I first went to the Library of Congress, wanted to take our maps there, I had a question, and they said, okay, you need to contact this man in Beijing. Now, the man in Beijing, Dr. Li, had been working at the Library of Congress and had seen this map. And he says, you need to ask to get into the vault to see this map. Now, this particular map is dated, they've carbon dated it to the late 14th century. And yet they refused to fully verify it. Now, this map has on it, and I've seen it, and my husband and brother and several other people have seen this map. It has both European script and Asian script on it. It shows Asia and part of North America, including Alaska and a little bit south of that. But even though the Library of Congress has had this map for over 50 years, they have not fully verified it.
What does that mean when they have to verify it? Is that an authentication process or what is it?
Right.
Who authenticates it?
Well, I would think that they would. You know, there's a map division, specific geography and maps division at the Library of Congress. Now, for the Chinese maps and the Asian maps, they had brought in this Dr. Li from Peking University to study those. But I don't know why they have not gone ahead with this particular map, because to me it's something that's very important. Did the Chinese get to America before Columbus? Now, of course, this is just, you know, a few years before Columbus because it's late 14th century. But what I'm saying in our maps, the information I found about our style maps precedes Columbus by not just hundreds of years, but thousands of years.
Do you think that it's a conscious attempt on part of the Library of Congress to not want to deal with that potential information? The way it's looking.
At this point, yes. I have waited patiently for many years for them to either verify it or deny it.
Do they have to?
Do they have to?
Yeah. Who is the Library of Congress? Can you explain that to the listeners?
Okay, it's a government agency. It's also where all books are copyrighted, but it's also has the most important maps in the world, probably the most important map collection in the world, extensive collections. It has George Washington's maps, which they showed us. It has all kinds of ancient maps. The vault is larger than a football field. With shelves, they're flat shelves with drawers that they pull out with different layers of maps in them. It's a wonderful collection that they have of maps. Of course, they're not required to verify any map, but I would think that a map of this importance in this day and age, they would want to verify.
Well, I think the telling of the desire for verification begins with who is the Library of Congress? What are they about? Not just what they have a collection of. Do they want to know that? Maybe they don't want to know that.
Originally, they were set up to be the library that Congress would use, that the Congress of the United States would use. But now they are the main library of the United States of America. So if you want to have any book in the United States through interlibrary loan, many of the books at the Library of Congress you can get through your own library through interlibrary loan from this main library in the United States.
You know, sometimes, Charlotte, in any endeavor, actually not sometimes, a lot of times, you have to know people or know people who can help get things done from the inside of the Library of Congress, for example.
Right.
Maybe there are certain people, it's like contacting any organization, only you have this other level of bureaucracy, and maybe somebody from inside the Library of Congress needs to get excited about this and help shepherd it, a lot of times makes things easier to get done. But let's suppose that it's not verified and they continue to not respond to your information requests.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, virtually that they're hiding the information, in my opinion.
Yeah.
In my opinion, that's what it is. Now, I do have the support of the man who was the chief of the Asian Division of the Library of Congress until 2008. He has endorsed my book, Secret Maps of the Ancient World, and continues to endorse me and my research. He believes that there's much evidence that Chinese did come to America at very early dates.
Dr. Robert Schlock's book, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, why was his book important and relevant and connected to the Chinese and American connection?
Well, Robert Schlock, in studying the pyramids around the world, got to the pyramids in Mexico and said that they are so similar to the pyramids in China that they had, whoever built them had to have been supervised by Chinese. The step pyramids, they just look like a series of steps. And when you put pictures of them side by side, they look almost identical. But in his book, Robert Schlock said that he thought that there was no evidence that Chinese had reached America. Now, in some ways, I'm probably too bold, but I contacted Robert Schlock and I said, but there is evidence. There's a Smithsonian excavation that was done several years ago, and they found Chinese writing, the Shang Dynasty Chinese writing, in that very area that he was talking about, La Venta, Mexico. And in fact, Chinese writing has been found in multiple sites in Central, South, North America, 8 different states in North America. And so Chinese writing has been found. And also there's other evidence, including the elongating of heads, which the Chinese were doing at that same era of time. The elongated heads in La Venta, Mexico are most likely related to the elongated heads in China.
How does this relate to the Olmec culture? Apparently, this is a very important culture we need to know about.
Okay, now to start out with, the Olmec culture is actually a name that people invented because they didn't know the name of the culture. And it's a culture that suddenly appeared full bloom around 1100 to 1200 BC, had writing, it had architecture, and they have no explanation where this culture came from. Now, there is a good explanation of where it came from if they came over the seas. And at that time, there was a bloodbath in China. Many people fled to sea. And they said that at that time, a quarter of a million people disappeared from China, never came back, and they're not sure where they went to. Well, you know, if you look, okay, they could have ridden the currents across to the Americas. They could have settled here, had their culture here. So that's where I believe that the Olmec came from.
Now, you talk about that current in your book. There's a huge current in the ocean. Talk about that.
Okay, the current, which is some people call the Japan current, is actually a warm current. It goes up beside Taiwan, then it goes beside Japan and comes over the Pacific Ocean. It's actually a circle, so it's a gyre or a circle. And this current is 62 miles wide and half a mile deep. It's an enormous current. And if you get into this current, you don't have to have a sail. It's like a moving sidewalk. You can just sit on there, and it will bring you over to the American coastline. And it comes down the coast of North America, and then further south, it will go back west again and then continues the circle. So there are other circles like this in the oceans of the world, but this enormous current could actually bring ships or boats or whatever over. And like I said, you don't even have to have a sail. It could have even been a raft in this current.
Is this what is coined the Great Conveyor?
Yes, it's a great conveyor that would bring items over. And it's warm, so they could have sat there on this and shipped and fished the whole way across. In fact, in the 20th century, several groups have tested it out. There's a of a group in 62 that arrived in Long Beach, California on a 39-foot sailing boat. They had started out in Japan, and in 57 days they were across. It was three people, and a story about it appeared in the paper in Long Beach, California.
Wow. I noticed that you take very mindful care of introducing the reader to DNA testing.
Right.
And I guess you're a proponent of DNA testing. And what was interesting to find out is that there's two types of DNA testing. I guess the chromosomes of the nucleus and the mitochondrial or mtDNA.
Correct.
Talk about it.
Okay. In the nucleus, that changes from person to person. You know, every person is an individual. But the mitochondrial DNA passes virtually unchanged from mother to child. The mitochondrial DNA passes unchanged from mother to daughter for generations. Actually, it passes to the son, but the son doesn't pass it on. So it's, if you go, they study the mitochondrial DNA, or they could study the Y chromosome DNA. But usually mitochondrial DNA, which passes from the mother to child. And so, unlike the other type of DNA, which changes from person to person, this one passes unchanged, and it's easy to access, and so it's much easier to study.
Isn't it nerve-wracking to be looking into that, because then you see waves of migrations and where groups of people and cultures of people have come from? I also read that in your book that there's this great sensitivity about the American Indians, and then there's these two different factions of thinking out there about them being the original natives here. And in looking at that, how it kind of ruffles feathers to look at the potential that they came possibly from somewhere else, or that there was some type of a mixed culture.
Right, and some people are sensitive to that. But I think that if we want to be academically honest, we would accept DNA if it was a relative of ours who had been murdered and we were trying to find who did it. If we would accept that DNA as conclusive evidence. So I think that we should accept the DNA if it's drawn in a culturally acceptable way, or if it's done, you know, not to prove a crime, but if it's done in a way that the person donated it themselves, that we should accept that DNA and what it shows. And the DNA that has been tested of Native Americans, and they've tested over up to 200 tribes now, that does show that they come from Asia. Now, there are four main haplogroups of these people.
What's a haplogroup?
Haplogroups. They divide DNA into different divisions. And not everyone in Asia has these same haplogroups, and they've named them A, B, C, and D. But the Han Chinese do have all four of those haplogroups. Now, there is a very small percentage, less than 1% of the Native Americans have the X haplogroup. And X haplogroup is found in Europe, Eastern Europe, but it is also found in Northern China.
Is this the work you quoted by Dr. Simone Southerton?
Simon Southerton.
Simon Southerton, Losing a Lost Tribe. Have you read it?
Yes, I have.
Is that the essence of, is it a study or?
Well, Southerton was a microbiologist, or in fact, he still is a microbiologist in Australia, but he was also a bishop in the Mormon Church. And the Mormon Church teaches that the lost tribe of Israel is the origin of the Native Americans. And so he had a conflict of what he was seeing at work and what he was studying, his religious beliefs. So he took this to the Mormon Church, and they basically told him, well, just go pray about it. So he left the Mormon Church, and then they excommunicated him. But Southerton, that's why it's called Losing a Lost Tribe, because he doesn't think that the Native Americans came from the Middle East at all because of the DNA evidence. But he also points out that not only is the Native American DNA the same as that of the Asians, but they also have the same parasites and viruses as is found in Asia.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. So the breast milk of the Native Americans can't contain the same parasites as are found in Asia. And there's some intestinal parasites that are found in Native Americans that are found only in Asians.
I had no idea that in ancient times, maps were considered precious state secrets. In other words, they were very secretive about maps. People were very secretive about maps. Why?
Well, because they believed they held state secrets.
How would you tell a state secret, like where something is on a map?
Well, for instance, we're told that the maps, the map collection that we have would have only been owned by a government person, because some of the maps in our map books tell where the water wells are, where the people would hide if the country's attacked, where the postal stations are, where the military stations are. So that type of information they wouldn't want everybody to know.
Well, thank God they weren't living in today's times with people like the Google folks, because they would freak. They would freak out. I mean, you can just put someone's address on there and you'll be looking at their front door.
That's correct. It's kind of spooky sometimes.
Indeed. I noticed that Dr. Simone felt that dogs were brought here to America from China.
Well, he said some of them.
Some of them.
I don't know. He
like the American Grey Wolf, a distant cousin, and that was interesting.
Right.
The Chinese had the first mechanical clock 583 years before the Europeans. That was an amazing read, that a Buddhist monk had figured that out.
There are many inventions that the Chinese had before America, and the Chinese were far advanced for hundreds of years, far more advanced than the Western culture for many, many years. And then it was about the time that, it was about the 15th century, that things suddenly switched. Europe came out of the Dark Ages and China went into them when they shut down to the outside world.
I understand you met Gavin Menzies. Did you meet him in the Library of Congress?
Yes, I've met him more than one time. We met after 2 years. I had read his book, 1421, and at that time I sent him an email saying, "You did a wonderful job in writing this book, but I think that there's evidence that Chinese got here before 1421, even in his own book." And so I told him that we had some maps. Well, at the time he said thank you, but we didn't make contact. Well, 2 years later, he sent me an email and said, "I need to see those maps." And so at that time we met in late 2004, at the Library of Congress, and he saw the maps. And at that time, he said, "I don't think there's a chance in 100,000 that your father was wrong." And he said, "I want to help you." Well, it scared me to death that a best-selling author was wanting to help me, and I was a little bit dubious about all this, but he has been extremely helpful to me.
He has a great love for exploration and discovery, and he said that he's open to being wrong, and he loves it that people participate in the process. He has kind of like open source into exploration and discovery, which I find incredible.
Right.
And he's totally willing for other people to find things that predated anything he found. So I think it's extraordinary that he's open to you.
I think he will go down in history as a great man, because he has opened the door. For years, different people have been trying to put forward a different piece of this puzzle. And but no one was listening. But Gavin was able to get the world's attention. Yes, the Chinese were here before Columbus. And he also told us in April, my husband and I visited his home in London, visited him and his wife, and he told us then that all the money that he has made or had made up to that point from his books, he had put back into research. So I believe that he has been a great person, and he's been helpful not only to me, but also to several others who are studying the subject.
That's extraordinary. Confucius. You talk about Confucius. I noticed that they also spoke of rain dances.
Yes.
And Confucius spoke about the eastern places. What did he say?
Well, Confucius talked about people coming and going from other countries across the sea. And this was 500 B.C. So at that time, Chinese were not only going other places, but other people were coming as emissaries to China. And Confucius even talked himself about wanting to go across the sea. And one of the things that I mentioned in that is that the name of our map is Tian Xia, which means everything under heaven or the whole earth. And I mentioned that Confucius also mentioned Tian Xia, those exact words, and I had someone check that to make sure it was the exact words, and sure enough it is. Well, just recently a Confucian scholar contacted me, and he said, well, Confucius didn't mention this just once, but 23 times, the whole earth. And so he thought it was a great discovery that we had realized that Confucius was talking about ancient people traveling.
Many of us would not think that the sea navigational ability and technology was great at that time. Apparently it was.
Right. Right, it was.
How do we know that?
Well, they've found parts of the ships. They have found writings about the ships. One man has written a book called Chinese Maritime Activity, 2100 B.C. through 1900 A.D. And that book lists in detail what the Chinese were doing. The first recorded skirmish that the Chinese had was 549 B.C., and it was a sea skirmish, the first recorded sea skirmish. And during the Warring States period, Joseph Needham, who's considered the leading scholar on Chinese, all things Chinese, he wrote that during the Warring States period, which was from 403 through 221 B.C., that the Chinese even realized about this great current in the ocean, and that they realized that it was perpetually flowing northeast. And then later they actually came up with a name for it. They called it the Wei Lu. And so ordinary people were not only coming into China, but going out of China at early dates. And at one time they were making so many ships that they had to import wood from outside of China. They almost ran out of wood in China. And many of these ships were privately owned. So people were traveling, going, coming. By 1405, when Zheng He had his ships, now Zheng He was a Chinese admiral who sailed the seas between 1405 through 1433, and there's an article in National Geographic, July 2005, telling about the size of his ships. His ships were larger than a football field, 400 feet long by 170 feet wide, five-deck ships.
That's like a cruise line, isn't it, or bigger?
Right. I would think it would be the size of a cruise liner. You could put 10 of Columbus's largest ship into one of Zheng He's ships. And so if someone wants to see that, they can go to that July 2005 National Geographic and just see an article about the enormous size of these ships. And we know they were real because they found parts of them.
Don't you think that a lot of parents are nervous to hear this kind of information because it's inconsistent with what children and young teens are being taught in school? On some levels, the parents that may not be excited about new knowledge or new discoveries, right?
Well, I think that there is a fear of Caucasians, of Asians. I think that there has been that fear for years. But I don't think that people should think that Chinese are going to try to come back and claim America because of this, any more than the British or the French will come back and claim America because that they colonized America. I think that it's ridiculous. maybe you can compare it to this. I just found out this last week that a distant relative of mine is doing a genealogy study, and I found out that I'm related in the 13th century to a king of Scotland.
Wow.
So does that mean that you should bow down to me now? No. You know, what difference does it make now? None. But it is an interesting point. And just, I bring this up to say that history, when we go back and study history, it doesn't change the present other than maybe we won't repeat the same mistakes. But it doesn't mean that now I'm the Queen of Scotland or something, you know. So it doesn't, the Chinese won't come back and claim America. I have no doubt about that.
George Carter, in your book you quoted, had said that the founding of the Smithsonian Institution and Bureau of American Indian Affairs has kind of preempted a denial of overseas contacts and kind of been responsible for setting in concrete this dogma that we came from here only. And basically the essence of it is that other institutions have been part of establishing this dogma, which makes it very hard to receive new knowledge, new discovery, new information. Do you agree?
You know, I did read that Carter said that. I've had a hard time understanding some things. My father had said that he had a history book that showed that Chinese discovered America. I think it was from about 1910, and it was being taught in American schools at that time. And so I went to Dr. Covey, who's been my research mentor, by the way. He has been an invaluable help to me. And I went to Dr. Covey and I said, is this true that it used to be in American textbooks? And he said, yes. And he also said the same thing that George Carter said, that it was in American textbooks, that Chinese had an early presence in America, that they had been here at least 1,000 years. And then about that time, it was taken out of textbooks. Just recently, I found in an antique shop a teacher's guide, and it was dated 1905, and it says the same thing, that the Native Americans came from Asia, and that was the origin of the Native Americans. But in the same shop, the books dated after that, after about 1910 or 1915, they take that information out.
I wonder how much of our history, across the board, by the way, everywhere, there's been this sensitivity of territory. Because that's really what we're talking about, isn't it? It's territoriality and ownership of land and space and claiming. And I wonder how much of the removal of information like this has happened on a broad level.
That's a good question. I don't know. One thing that has perplexed me is that everybody admits that there were people in the Americas since at least 2000 BC. Everybody admits that. But when we study history, American history, we start with only 500 years ago. So what happened to the rest of that history?
I love that question. I have another question.
Okay.
So who authorizes what gets into the history books for children? Who determines that?
Okay. Now, I heard Gavin Menzies say recently it's determined by peer review, that the teachers themselves authorize that. So if they've written a book saying that Columbus discovered America, they don't want somebody else to come up with a book saying Columbus didn't discover America.
We're doing a show on peer review coming up in 2 weeks.
I that will be interesting. I would like to listen to that.
Because there's two types of peer review, I've been told. There's one that has to do with books, and there's another one that has to do with articles or publications that are not books. Mm-hmm. And they have different ramifications and issues, like two tiers,
right,
for peer review. But it's a very important question, because accepted history, accepted precedent, our frame of reference for what is and how it came to be, is established in our youth and then concretized, right? If we're not curious anymore, and you know how as they age, Most people get less curious, and a lot of people maintain their childhood wonder of life, like right. you mm-hmm. and like me. I love to learn. I love to learn. It's a great passion of mine, and I will learn my whole life. But a lot of people need to know and feel a need to have a handle on what is and what isn't and how it came to be, which can obstruct learning.
Right. But, you know, the internet has been one thing that's been wonderful, because even though it's not accepted by some people, you can put information out there, and it's available to many people. And I believe that many people are finding out that Chinese were in the Americas before Columbus. And by the way, what they say about the DNA of the Native Americans is that the founding DNA is from Asia. So it's not just a recent infusion. It's something that's been here thousands of years.
Wow. So it kind of points to, we have to keep looking. We have to stay open and keep looking. And new information becomes available, and new connections, and putting the puzzle pieces together. I liked how you described that in your book about putting the puzzle pieces together, and it's like a great exploration. You must have an incredibly exciting life, putting the pieces together, being in the area of discovery, exploring for a living, and then writing about it and sharing about it.
Well, it is interesting. I get new information almost daily, and I communicate with people around the world, but I'm an ordinary person like everybody else. I have to go grocery shopping, and I have to clean my house. So, you know, I'm just like everybody else, but I'm inquisitive, and I have the time right now in my life to study these subjects.
What do your sisters and brothers say about your work, what you've discovered? I mean, all of these maps were sitting under what, your brother's bed after your dad passed away?
Right.
How are they responding to what you've pulled together and pieced together? Are they excited? What's their sentiment about it?
Well, there's seven of us. And I say sometimes if we got together and voted on what day of the week it was, we would probably each come up with a different answer.
I hear you. I think a lot of us have that in our families.
So there are various reactions, and some have been very supportive, and some have been a little bit dubious. So, but I still love them. They're my brothers and sisters.
Wow. What's next for you, and what is your focus on today?
Well, I'm working on a book about my father. I was actually asked to write this book first, and I said, well, I need to go back and write the book, you know, explain his book first, and then do mine, and then do my father's. I am working on that book. Not today. Actually, today I'm taking care of some correspondence and mailing out some books and other things. But that's my main focus this spring. I'm getting ready for a speech in Malacca, Malaysia. That will be in July. And also I will be speaking at the National Library of China in July.
Wow. Which part of China?
It's in Beijing. That's like their Library of Congress.
Wow.
So I'm very excited about that opportunity, and that will be very interesting. It will be in the MAPS division.
Now, are you speaking all over the world? Are you on call for speaking engagements? Can schools hire you to come in and speak?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm available to speak. This spring, I'm trying to hold back a little bit because I want to get this book finished, but I am booking things for the fall, maybe a few for the spring, but if I don't have to travel too far.
Do you think high schools and grammar schools would be willing to bring you in? I mean, I would think it would be such a breakthrough thing if school systems could become open and that this book became available to teachers that were teaching history.
Right.
Hey, because, you know, if you don't have the teacher's backing, you have curriculum, so you keep passing the same information over and over again over time. And as we all know, you can say something over and over again and just keep repeating it, and then people will take it as being the truth. So I think if this book were sent, were made available to teachers in grammar school and high school and history, this is a very important book.
Well, I feel so, and when it came out, Secret Maps first came out, Gavin Menzies said that he hoped that within 10 years it would be in every American school, And I'm hoping that we'll also be in every Chinese school because they need to know some of this information. Over the years, China has lost a lot of information. They have such a long history, and there have been different times when information has been destroyed through fires or wars. So they themselves don't even know their full history, and they're exploring that now. But I'm piecing together not only information from America, but from Asia, trying to piece all of this together so that all of us can look at it. And if somebody reads it and doesn't agree with me, you know, they have that right. I'm not saying everybody has to agree with me, but I'm saying look at these facts, and then you come to your own conclusion after you read these facts. And the facts I'm putting together are not my studies, but mainly academic studies that have been done where some people have studied 20 years on one little aspect of this.
There's two kinds of maps. There's what they call the real maps, and there's imaginary maps. I noticed it was mentioned in your book. How does one distinguish? I know you said through verifying, but how does one verify that?
Oh, okay. What I mentioned was that initially when this map, my father's style map, was regarded as part real and part imaginary. Now, I've never heard of such a map. What they mentioned was that China, Japan, Korea, that part was real. But the outer edges of the map had to be imaginary, and I think it was because of their paradigm. They didn't think anybody could travel that far that early. And so now they're finally admitting that, no, this is a real world map, but then they're going back and trying to revise the date that it came out. But we have Chinese, Japanese, and Korean sources that lists this map as before Columbus, and some by thousands of years before Columbus. So not our particular maps, but this style map.
Right. But again, for authentication purposes, how is authentication usually manifested when it comes to maps?
Well, they carbon date the map, and also they look at the information on the map. But also one of the things that In our particular case of this style map, you look at what's been written about this style map and down through history, and has it been quoted? And yes, it's been quoted and described verbally, you know, as a round map and other things on it. I think one of the things that I found out recently is that on the far right side of our map, where my father says it's America and I believe to be America, someone recently approached me, and this man has a PhD in environmental studies, and he said, you have a sequoia tree on the right side of the map. And I said, what? And it's the Fusang tree, and Fusang is the country where they said they were going. Well, it's like the branch of a sequoia tree or giant redwood. And Chinese did, down through their histories, talk about the enormous trees in Fusang. And by 300 B.C., of the 3rd century B.C., they were saying that Fusang, or America, was 3,300 miles wide. Now, they didn't say it in miles. They said it in li, which when you translate it to miles, it comes out to 3,300 miles wide, which is almost the exact width of America.
Wow.
And then they said you get to this other big blue ocean. And meanwhile, they say that there are these enormous trees in Fusang. So when you put all these things together, and then you get the map saying, okay, this is Fusang, and this is where it is. And then there are verbal descriptions. There's verbal descriptions from the 7th century that say to get to Fusang, then you go to, coming from China, you go such and such, and you go to Japan, and then you go east from there, and then you go to Dahan, and then you go to Fusang. Well, Dahan and Fusang are on our maps, and Fusang is where we think America is, and Dahan is actually where Alaska would be.
Have you had any opposition and or mean-spirited letters, emails, put-downs, anything?
Yes. but amazingly, where it came from, when I spoke at the Library of Congress in 2005, and by the way, Gavin Menzies had been invited to speak at a symposium at the Library of Congress in 2005, and he said, I will come if you will also let Charlotte Reese come, and you will let, you know, he had a couple other, two or three other people come. And so that's how I got to speak at the Library of Congress in 2005, because of Gavin's generosity. But anyway, at that time, there was somebody from Singapore who was trying to prevent us from speaking at the Library of Congress because he did not like Gavin Menzies. Now, Gavin has had some very mean-spirited things said about him and done to him. I haven't had too much, but at that one occasion, this person wrote to the Library of Congress, tried to prevent it. And the chief of the Asian division, Dr. Hua Hui Li, who is the one who supports me now, he replied and he said, listen, he said, this is America. We have freedom of speech. People don't have to believe what's said, but we have freedom to say what we want. And you in another country can't say what we can have. And so we went ahead and had this symposium.
That's extraordinary.
And then the same man came back again, and when I spoke at Stanford University last fall, he contacted the president of the Stanford of Stanford University and tried to prevent me from talking. And the president of Stanford University, or I was speaking at the Hoover Institution, and they said, no, we're going to still have Charlotte speak. So I got to still speak.
Because I know there's been a real hit campaign on Gavin Menzies' 1421
right.
book and information, and there's a whole 1421 exposed website to counter everything he said, and a huge hit campaign on him. I wonder why.
You know, I don't know, but I also wonder how anybody has that much time to spend their whole life trying to degrade somebody else. Let's all do something positive. And if once in a while, all of us are wrong about some point, you know, but let's try to find the right ones, not the wrong ones.
The thing I love about what he's doing is that he's totally willing to be wrong. He's willing
right.
to involve everybody. Look at the information that you brought in. 1421 was the year, supposedly, that the Chinese discovered America. But then you come around with secret maps of the ancient world that show that, hey, the Chinese were here thousands of years before that. And still fantastic.
Right.
And he welcomed you. I mean, that is miraculous. Usually in academia or any type of publishing,
right.
people get bent out of shape if anybody comes in with something that is beyond the mark that they made or that adds a different dimension to it or that counters it, et cetera. So
right.
I think that is one of the great lessons of all of this, don't you?
Right. Right, I do, and I think he has been extremely generous. He actually even advertises my books on his website at no charge to me.
That's how I found out about you, and that's how I found out about your book.
And, I mean, you just don't hear about that. But in the meantime, 1421 is still selling well, and the information about Zheng He, I believe, is correct that he writes in 1421. Zheng He was a very colorful figure, and I don't know if you've read
I did
that
read book. 1421.
Right.
I loved the way it read, actually. It was so eloquent. It was like you were live. It was happening right as you're reading it.
Right, right. He did a marvelous job on 1421. And if you look on Amazon, and you can rank, see how books are ranking, how they're selling day by day, hour by hour. And 1421 continues to sell well. In fact, when I saw Gavin last April, he said that his books were selling better now than they've ever sold. And you'd think, okay, after all these years of selling millions of books, you're going to get to the point where everybody in the world has a copy, but they don't.
Well, I hope that everybody in the world has a copy of his book and your book, Secret Maps of the Ancient World.
Well, thank you, Kim. And can I mention my website?
Please.
It's www.harrismaps.com.
And that is www.harris, harrismaps.com.
Yes.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to audiences regarding your work or anything to them about your findings of and really your calling now with Secret Maps of the Ancient World?
Well, I was very dubious for many years about all this, and so I really didn't get into this until about early 2003. And so I understand when people are dubious, but I just ask them that they check it out, read the information. They don't even have to buy my book. They can get it through interlibrary loan, but read it and see what they think. And I love getting emails from people, and I love it that you asked me to do this today, Kim.
I'm honored and I'm so excited about your work. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been listening to Charlotte Harris Rees, the author of Secret Maps of the Ancient World and the Asiatic Fathers of America, Chinese Discovery and Colonization of Ancient America. She can be reached at www.harrismaps.com. It is an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for your work. It is my sincere wish that your book is in every single school in America for youth to rethink history. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Kim.
God bless you.
God bless you, too.